Today is June 23rd. This is Greg Waters. I'm here with Jessica Martucci, and this is part two of our interview with Dr. Rory Cooper. Good morning.
Good morning.
I did want to go back. We finished basically yesterday at the end of your PhD program. I did want to go back and ask a couple follow-up questions about your work. On your resume, it says that basically right after your injury in 1981, you began working with the Equalizer Wheelchair Company.
Yeah.
Could you talk about how you got connected with them and what kind of work you were doing?
I got connected to them in a very odd way. This guy, Craig Bash, who was working with Equalizer as a wheelchair user, he was kind of the sort of the original brainchild of the chair. I happened to just meet him at the farmer's market in San Luis Obispo on the street, and he noticed that I had built my own chair, and he was using a chair that he built, and we just kind of started talking about, and then that I was going to Cal Poly and studying engineering, and he said he was working for Equalizer with Craig Vetter. And that makes like Vetter fairings and motorcycle helmets and that. And so, and that they had that Craig had a house in San Luis Obispo, and they had a small shop where they were designing they were creating this new wheelchair, mm-hmm. basically. They asked me to come up and worked, I was a student there as a consultant on various aspects of the design. And then they also, I was involved in wheelchair racing, and they got connected to Jim Knob, who was one of the top wheelchair racers in the world at the time. And so they wanted to make a racing chair for Jim, so I kind of got engaged in that project too.
And then shortly thereafter in 82, Cooper Engineering Company. Was that a pre-existing company, or is that when you started?
So that was a spin-off of my parents' automotive machine job. I started making, I gave it a try to design and sell my own sports wheelchairs, mm-hmm. like racing chair, hand cycle, and rollers. And actually Jim Knob actually wound up using my rollers, and Bobby Hall, who was a wheelchair manufacturer, he bought some of my rollers and distributed some of the rollers. Eventually, Quickie Wheelchairs bought me out.
Nice.
They never really brought any of the products to market that I was making, but they adopted them into their designs.
Gotcha. So were you familiar at all with wheelchair design prior to your injury?
No,
not at all. And immediately upon being in a wheelchair yourself, did you just see all kinds of problems with the current designs?
Yeah.
What were some of those?
Well, they were like 80 pounds and steel, and you know, there were three different sizes, more like a 16, 18, and 20 inches. Didn't take a lot of knowledge to be able to give people a wheelchair, and they all had kind of these Naga hide seats. Frankly, they were just bad. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, there were some people like Bobby Hall and Jim Martinson and Marilyn Hamilton in the United States, and Rainer Kuschel, mm-hmm. and Errol Markline in Europe that were starting to build their own chairs and starting to sell them. And I got started because I got out of the hospital and I had this 80-pound Invicare Rolls wheelchair, and I knew I wanted to go to college, and I started trying to push it a mile a day, and after about 6 weeks it just basically started falling apart. And my Army unit organized a fun run, mm-hmm. and they raised the money to buy me a Quadra wheelchair, which was also two wheelchair users, Jeff Meenebraker and Brad Parks, had kind of created that small company. It was a pretty cool chair, except for They made a lot of parts by hand, and their quality control wasn't that great. So it was a good concept, but it wasn't. And actually, that Marilyn Hamilton kind of came along and with Jim Akimoto and Dave Counts and stuff, and they started using like computer numerically controlled machining and higher qualities, you know, higher tolerances and things, really move things along. I started out making chairs basically for myself, sort of consulting with Craig Vetter and Craig Bash, but also wanted to build a better racing chair, building a the hand cycles, because triathlons were just kind of catching on. I wanted to do a triathlon, so that was kind of where I started working on that. And rollers was a way to do a state, that's a stationary trainer. It's a way to train on your racing chair without, if it's a rainy day or too cold outside.
So like a treadmill, basically?
Yep.
Okay, gotcha. Can you talk about wheelchair racing? Basically, immediately upon being injured, you jumped into wheelchair racing.
I did. Yeah, I loved it. I was bad at first. And I'd sort of started in the back of the pack. And my wife, who was a dancer and a gymnast, would jog along with me. And But I got in better shape, and I started building better chairs, and eventually started kind of finishing in the middle of the pack, and then eventually finishing towards the front, and eventually got to the point where I could win some races. My wife still kids me to this day that I'm a better engineer than I am an athlete, so I was able to stay one step ahead of the competition a little bit by my technological advances. And that was kind of fun in the entire 1980s, was because the chairs were changing so fast that I'd come up with an innovation or somebody else would come up with an innovation. You'd have like a 1 month advantage and then get to a couple races and then somebody would build upon that.
Well, I was going to say, it seems like it would be a collaborative effort to make the wheelchair better. But if you're racing, there's a competition involved. So you want to keep it secret, or do you want to...
Well, the problem is you can't really keep it secret, right? I mean, once they come show up to the race, they see it. And
So there wasn't much sharing going on, though?
They were sharing. We weren't really patenting things, and people were sharing. You kind of, you know, you realize it didn't take you long to figure out that after a couple of races that there was competition. People try to get faster, but there was a lot of sharing too, because we were trying to make the sport itself better and make everybody faster. You know, first it was, can we get as fast as the runners, right? Yeah. And then it was, after that, it was just, you know, how fast can we go and stay with. And we worked a push to change the rules. I was pretty engaged in that process.
How so?
Well, originally, racing chairs had to be four wheels. And so I did some, you know, I skirted around the rules on that a little bit by hanging like a, you know, tiny toy car wheel off the side. Or, and they said all four wheels have to contact the ground. So, of course, you had the little tiny wheel on a piece of piano wire touching the ground. and then so I think they eventually gave up and let us, I tried, you know, had, and then the wheelbase was limited. You could only be 120 centimeters long. That's pretty, from tip to toe, that's pretty short. And we argued that caused a lot of accidents and things, and so the wheelbase got extended. That really made a three-wheelers practical.
Gotcha.
And allowed people to change their body position so you could lean more forward and get more power into the push rims, and that changed the sport dramatically. We clipped the push rims onto the spokes. A lot of people thought that you couldn't do that. They would break. That was actually something we did with Equalizer. We kind of were the first ones to do that. Actually, we played early on with ergonomic shapes of push rims, what was kind of the optimal shape rather than just a round tube.
Yeah.
Steering gear was another one, and that was illegal for a while. The steering gear had to be, wheels had to freely caster, but we showed that the steering gear actually made not only the sport faster but safer, and risk of injuring the wrists and shoulders as well from repetitive strain injuries from always sort of pushing on with the right arm harder because of the turns on the track.
Gotcha.
Or compensating for the road crown on the road. So, but you know, that's what sport's supposed to be like, right? It involves.
Right.
I use the example of pole vaulting, right? People used to pole vault with a bamboo pole, then they pole vaulted with an aluminum pole, then fiberglass poles and carbon fiber poles, and you know, bamboo poles, you could only go so high, one, because it didn't flex, so you had, it could only go, couldn't go higher than the pole. You couldn't actually put too much force in it or the pole would shatter. So aluminum poles stopped the poles from shattering, but they didn't flex either, so you had to basically couldn't go higher than the pole. And then the fiberglass poles came in, and the poles not only could hold, be stronger, but they could flex. And then the carbon fiber poles were even stronger, could flex even more and give you better energy return, and people went even higher. So they changed the sport over all those times.
Were the people participating in the wheelchair racing sport primarily veterans?
So there were a lot of veterans early on, a lot of the, you know, a lot of Vietnam. So World War II veterans really started wheelchairs. I mean, World War, actually, that's not true. World War I veterans actually started wheelchair sports. You know, they started playing softball and volleyball, and the chairs were pretty bad, but they wanted to be active, and that was kind of the first concepts of using activity, both work-related activities and sports and recreation-related activities as part of rehab. And then in World War II, it really kind of ballooned. That's the Paralympic movement. It's basically a spinoff of World War II. It's hard to say who was... Wheelchair basketball also started in World War II. So the United States, Paralyzed Veterans of America, started wheelchair basketball. So every major war, Vietnam, you know, was a big... snow skiing really kind of started. There was sort of the sled skiing, polk skiing before that, but like the motto ski is an evolution out of from the Vietnam era veterans. Wheelchair racing had started after World War II, but the demand for better chairs and moving away from the Everest and Jennings chairs and the Invacare chairs of the day towards the modern chairs that we see today. That's a result of mostly Vietnam-era veterans. I mean, Marilyn is not a veteran, neither is Bobby Hall. Jim Martinson is a Vietnam veteran. So it was a little bit of both, right? But
Can I ask another follow-up? So you were making a lot of innovations in the 1980s, and you said that that's sort of like a period that a lot of other people were starting to make innovations as well with
right.
wheelchair design. What do you think it was about that decade, other than just like having Vietnam veterans around maybe?
So there's a couple things. The Rehab Act of 1973 basically became enacted in 1977. And that started to make high schools and colleges more mainstreaming. There was sort of this sort of two parallel movements. There was the disability rights movement that started in the 1960s with the Centers for Independent Living and getting people out of institutions. And at the same time, there was kind of the sports movement as well, and getting there were people wanted to be able to participate in mainstream sports, do road races, track, swimming, things like that. So they kind of went in parallel. The other thing that happened is that people, because of those two movements, people disabused themselves wanted to start running the sports organization. So they started challenging the technology, challenging the rules, challenging the venues. I mean, some of those early wheelchair track meets, for example, were held on around cones on parking lots rather than on real tracks. And then I think the other thing is it started to, the colleges and universities had to make plans in order to incorporate people with disabilities on campus. So that changed things too. People started getting an education. They started learning about, some people would go into adaptive sports and recreation, and they started coming up with ideas. People... only a handful of us went into engineering, but at least some of us did, and we started looking at it from that perspective. Then there was a runners movement, so that kind of drove things. There was the International Year of People with Disabilities in 1981 from the UN. That brought attention. The VA created the National Veterans Wheelchair Games in 1981, created by Tom Brown and some others. Tom Brown as himself was a wheelchair athlete, wheelchair track, field events and basketball. So I think it was kind of people started to come on their own. Hey, we can do these things ourselves. We can take care of ourselves. And that caused innovation, created innovation. So, you know, I'm very proud that I was part of that, you know, myself and like Marilyn Hamilton and Bobby Hall and Jim Martinson, Jeff Minnebreaker, and Brad Parks and others. And fun thing is we all know each other, right? Because we competed in sports against each other and we shared designs. And
do you think there was anything? I mean, was there anything?
Peter Axelson was another one. Yeah. Peter Axelson was another person, and he's also a veteran. He's more on the winter sports side, like cross-country skiing and downhill skiing.
You had mentioned that, like, when people started to build their own chairs, there were some quality control issues, but that once, like, more computerized, like, creation of the parts came along, that mm-hmm. might have helped. Was there a role that, like, technology was playing in this, like, period of innovation, like new technologies that were becoming available that were allowing people to build better chairs?
Oh, yeah. Well, aluminum came down in price, and some of the Kevlar and stuff like that, stuff like the home-built aircraft people started making that available. I used to buy a lot of chromoly and... Also carbon fiber and Kevlar from Aircraft Spruce and Specialty Company, which I learned about because a friend of mine's father was building a home-built aircraft, an ultralight aircraft, and so he gave me the catalog, and I thought, oh, look, there's all this cool stuff you can get for, I could use for wheelchair building in here. So that helped. And there was improvements in bicycle technology at the same time and started to adopt that into make better wheelchairs. So wheelchairs still use like open bearings back at that time. And, you know, the bicycle industry was starting to go with sealed bearings. And, you know, I used to actually, that's also the beauty of my parents having an automotive machine shop. The first bearings that I would use would be off of alternators or generators on cars when they went to like sealed bearings to last longer. We used to get the quick release pins on the chairs for the axles. They came from helicopters. From I used to basically comb the surplus stores, the military surplus stores, and when they would show up, basically buy all the. All the pins I could.
So was there any jealousy in the wheelchair racing community when you show up and you have a background in engineering and you were an athlete previously?
No, I didn't feel, no. Well, there are other people, a lot of people were athletes before. I mean, Jim Knob was an Olympic pole vaulter. It wasn't us against each other so much. It was really us against the rest of the world.
Right.
Right, so most of those people they're friends now. They were friends then. They're still friends of mine now. Right, and a lot of them are retired, but some are still innovators in other domains. Mm-hmm. Some in other businesses. And Marilyn is still now. She's still, like helping design therapeutic equipment. I mean, a lot of them, I think, liked the fact that I was an engineer. I would come up with something, design it, and then, you know, they'd copy it.
Yeah.
And other people came up with ideas, too, and I would copy their ideas, incorporate them. And like I said, we were really trying to move the sport ahead, right?
You did mention wheelchair triathlons.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that? How does a wheelchair triathlon work?
Same just a regular triathlon. You mm-hmm. get in the pool and swim.
Right.
Or the lake or river or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me. And then you have to use a hand cycle for the bicycle part.
Mm-hmm.
It's now a Paralympic sport, which is pretty cool. I was the first one to do an Olympic level Olympic distance triathlon. Use a racing chair for the quote running part.
Huh. And I know in the world of running. They have extreme triathlons and like extreme endurance races. Is that happening in wheelchair racing?
There's a few. Yeah, I mean, some people have done the Ironman. Carlos Molina is one of them. When Carlos was, he was a Navy SEAL injured in Panama. When I first met Carlos, kind of helped train him into wheelchair sports, and he's done the Ironman a few times. He's a great, great athlete. There's people that have done the Race Across America. It's actually been done in the 80s and 90s in their racing chair, and now in hand cycles. Rick Hansen, actually Canadian, is an ambassador, and he's a very prominent Canadian celebrity. Actually, he was, there's a bit of trivia, he was the Canadian Athlete of the Year, a title he shared that same year with Wayne Gretzky.
Nice.
And Rick actually pushed his racing chair around the world. First person to do that. That was in the, also in the late 1980s.
Interesting. So getting back to your career. In 1989, you began work at Cal State Sacramento.
Correct.
You were hired as an assistant professor in the Department of, Electrical and Electronic Engineering and Biomedical Engineering.
Correct.
At the same time, you were an assistant professor in the Assistive Device Center.
Yep.
You were hired to do both at the same time.
Yeah.
What was the Assistive Device Center? Was that already existing when you...
That was already existing. That was created by a professor named Al Cook.
What kind of work were they doing?
They provided technology, assistive technology to people with disabilities. So it was a clinic.
Okay. So it wasn't a lab. Was it creating new technologies?
Yeah. Well, at that time you had no choice.
Right.
So all the clinics at that time made technologies as well as delivered them. So that's actually kind of how the field of rehabilitation engineering started. I mean, it really started in the 60s, sort of started getting formalized in the 1980s. You had to, to this day, actually, we still fabricate things for certain clients. There's always some orphan products or somebody who's got an unmet need with existing commercial products. But at that time, that was pretty common. We'd literally be making cushions and backrests and inserts and specialty seating systems and alternative switch controls and writing custom software.
And was your role when you began at Cal State Sacramento, was that teaching or was that research? Was it both?
Everybody at Cal State Sacramento teaches. It's primarily a teaching school.
Gotcha.
But I did research there as well.
What were you teaching?
I taught rehabilitation engineering. I taught some robotics. I taught some control systems. And I taught some... medical instrumentation.
Gotcha. And then in 1990, they opened up the Human Engineering Laboratory.
Was that? I created that.
Created that, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had started to expand my research, and so I asked the department chair and the dean for some space and to create the Human Engineering Laboratory. Started to attract more students there.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of an offshoot of your work in the Assistive Device Center, was it?
This was
to
be more focused on research.
Okay.
The ATC didn't really do research per se. It did do new devices for individuals and would publish case studies. But its focus was on clinical service delivery.
Gotcha. And then in 1992, you got tenure?
Yeah.
Cal State? And then in 1994, you made the transition. You became a visiting professor first here at Pitt.
I did, yeah. I gave up a tenured string position to come to Pitt to be a visiting professor.
Gotcha. Can you talk about that? Was that a hard decision to make, or was that?
It was. But I wanted to take my chances to be at a major research university. Mm-hmm. They were starting this new department of rehab, science and technology, plus a bioengineering department at Pitt. Mm-hmm. And... I just see my postdoc advisor, Charlie Robinson, I've been appointed the first chair here. And he talked to me about coming out, what the opportunity would be. It took me about a year to kind of slide back and forth, but we decided to make the jump.
Okay.
Like we talked about earlier, I'd kind of learned the lesson that a lot of major universities hire people outside the tenure stream, and if you do well, mm-hmm. you have a chance to move in the tenure stream. So I took my chances.
And so you came to Pitt to found this lab?
Yep, to found Hurl, yeah.
Gotcha. So they said come and make a lab.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Work with the VA. And
that's an interesting partnership. So how did the VA become involved?
The VA became involved from the very beginning. I did my postdoc in the VA at Heinz VA in Chicago with Charlie and John Trimble. And they had a rehabilitation research and development center, which Hurl now is from the VA. And so I had VA funding from Sacramento. And the VA here in Pittsburgh did not have a lot of rehab rehab research and had, besides Charlie, no rehab engineering research. And they wanted to, and it makes sense. The VA has a long history of strong rehab engineering research dating back to World War II. And so in order for the university to build its research, to partner with the VA made sense. And we originally partnered with the Highland Drive VA, which no longer exists. But it was a neuropsychiatric VA and rehab center.
Okay.
So it had a lot, it was a kind of a nice place to get started.
So did they give you free rein when you came here and said, you have the vision, you set up the lab how you want it?
I don't know about free reign.
Right.
They gave me $25,000 in a bathroom and a locker room to start my lab in. We actually, the original Hurl was in our diet. My wife stayed in California to finish her degree for the first 6 months. So the original Hurl lab was in our basement and dining room. Once the VA found a bathroom and a locker room to give us a space, we moved into the bathroom and the locker room. My original office was literally the towel cage.
Nice.
And so some rather austere start. I guess if that you could call that free reign.
Did they give you a promise of funding for a certain amount of time? Or
nope. $25,000 in a bathroom and a locker room.
And that was it?
That was it. Sink or swim.
Gotcha. So how'd that go? Obviously it worked out.
I could swim.
Yeah.
I was able to bring a couple of grants with me from California, and we were able to get some success pretty quickly on with getting grants.
Gotcha. And I was going to ask about funding, how this lab works and how the history of the funding has changed over time, if it has.
It's changed tremendously. Well, early on, we were lucky. I found Mike Boninger, who was coming here as a postdoc, and we were able to get him supported on a NIDER postdoctoral fellowship grant, and he became the medical director, and then he was able to get an NIH KO8 award, Early Faculty Development Award, and that really helped a lot. Between him and I, we wrote grants, and for a while we were very successful and kept getting them. Now, so that's what we lived off of, basically. He had to provide some clinical services. He's an MD. I had to do some teaching and get my grants. The big change for us was in 1999, we were able to land a VA Rehabilitation Research and Development Center and a NIDER Spinal Cord Injury Model Systems grant. So that's what really changed things. The other thing that really helped us out is Paralyzed Veterans of America has always helped me in Sacramento. They would help out with small amounts of funding. When I moved from Sacramento to Pittsburgh, they also continue to contribute to funding, and they do to this day. That helped us quite a bit. And eventually they coordinate with some other foundations like the Pfizer Foundation, which is not Pfizer, the drug company, but Pfizer, F-I-S-A. And then we got engaged in wheelchair testing in the 1980s from Sacramento, and I had personally paid for some of that equipment, so I brought it with me. That got us early on in wheelchair testing, exposed us to some of the companies, and They sponsored some of our development work and some of our students as well, and got engaged with Dean Kamen and Johnson & Johnson on the Segway and the iBot. That helped us to sort of build up some corporate-sponsored research and development. That allowed us to get more space, hire more people, build a bigger team, go after more grants, bigger grants, and kind of led us to where we are now. How we're still funded today is, fortunately, we have a couple of endowments. So some people like the PVA and FISA Foundation and others have been generous enough to help contribute towards endowments. We have some donors that help support some of our program. We work with the university to set up like an individual donor campaign to support HURL and some of its individual programs. We still rely heavily on grants and contracts. We're pretty much a soft money organization. I'd love to find an endowment spot, a naming sponsor or something like that, right, that could give us some long-term security. It's a tough life, living in 3 and 5 year segments, which is the length of typical grants. At least having some small endowments and some gifts helps smooth out the peaks and the valleys to start some new ideas and fund some seed projects and to help people when they when they're struggling a little bit to bridge them between grants. So we've grown to basically a bathroom and a locker room to about 30,000 square feet and about 70 people to 70 to 100 in the summer. We balloon up to about 100 when we bring in the student interns. In the core, we've stayed the same. Our mission vision is pretty much it's been tweaked a little bit, but basically what it was. We've always engaged students. It's always been about teaching students in research and undergraduates, graduate students, and postdocs in research, creating new technologies that, creating and evaluating new technologies to change the lives for people with disability for the better, with a strong focus on the veterans population.
When you first started the lab, you were very well. Sacramento, in your own personal experience, you're very involved in wheelchair technology. Was that the focus in the beginning of starting the lab, or was it?
Yeah, the beginning was manual wheelchair technology. Mm-hmm. There was still a tremendous need for advancement. We've kind of moved, we still do a little bit of that, especially in the fitting and the ergonomics and transfers. There's we've disseminated a lot of that information. It's, I think, the clinicians, consumers understand it fairly well. Could do a little bit better on the uptake of the knowledge. All of healthcare kind of has that problem. We've driven the need has moved more towards power chairs, robotics. Smartphones are 10 years old now, so they offered an entire different opportunity for cognitive aids and using AI to improve adoption or get people to change their habits to be more healthy. So you've got to keep advancing the science and evolve to solve the next problems. Mm-hmm.
So what's your day-to-day, has it changed since the time that this lab has started? Because I know you've written 300 journal articles, several books, you have 20 patents.
Right.
You've been busy.
I've been busy. I'm still busy. That's not going to change.
Do you get to spend time in the lab?
I do. I don't know if I would do this anymore if I couldn't spend time in the lab. There's two kind of absolutes for me, and actually I guess three. If we're not having fun making a real positive difference, I don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. I want to be interacting with that my colleagues, my students, and my staff every day if possible, but at least several days per week. Mm-hmm. And so be directly engaged in the projects. I want to spend some time in the lab every day that I'm in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of the things that I strive for. So I usually start my day in the lab. I found that that's the easiest way to make sure I get time in the lab. If I go to the lab first and then come to the office, then I'll get time in the lab. If I come to the office, there's always somebody or some email or something waiting for me to take care of. So that's and then I usually take a. I have a bad habit. I drink one Coke a day, and I keep them in the lab so that and I go down there, and it gives me another hour or so to, depending on what my schedule allows, to go down and work in the lab and hopefully solve problems, if not kibitz, and see what's going on.
Could you talk about some of the major successes that you guys have had at Hurl? What you're most proud of? What products you've created?
Well, I mean, the one thing I'm most proud of is that we actually have Hurl. It's still here, 23 years later, right? And hopefully, we'll be here will be my legacy. The second most proudest thing is all the people that we've trained, the undergrad, the research experience for undergrad students, the postdocs, the doctoral students, graduate students that have gone out and have taken our message and our knowledge and built upon it and really helped build this field. And so, you know, those are the lasting accomplishments. Mm-hmm. All the devices will eventually become obsolete at some time, but hopefully we've trained people that are creating new devices. Like David Allgood, who's the vice president for Permobil, and just recently, like Jessica Berkman, who's now working for Next Health, and kind of just started her first job. She has a severe disability with cerebral palsy, so you know, those are the great things. That the devices. That's like asking to pick your favorite child, right? So. And they're all important in some ways. Mm-hmm. The natural fit hand rim and the surge hand rim have really had a tremendous impact on reducing the incidence of rotator cuff injuries and carpal tunnel syndrome, mm-hmm. and provided years of healthy mobility for people. So you've got to be very proud. You know, we're very proud of that accomplishment. The smart wheel, which I started as a graduate student, has changed how we prescribe manual wheelchairs and fitted and driven the whole field of wheelchair propulsion ergonomics. And mm-hmm. It's used widely throughout the world. We worked on the Pawpaw with Yamaha, the pusher immaculate power assist wheelchair, created an entirely new class of wheelchairs, and they're out there. And that's even in the kind of the pre-Hurl of the modern racing chair has its roots in the work that I did. Hmm. It still has a crown compensator very similar to what I designed. It has the push rims very similar to what I used. It has fenders that I invented. It has the side guards that I invented. It's the three-wheeler. I was one of the people to pioneer that. So, that every time somebody's out there racing, it's using that technology still. Hmm. And hand cycles, right? I was one of the first one to create hand cycles for racing, and now it's a whole sport in the Paralympics and see it in marathons, and I participate myself. So our virtual seating coach could make tremendous impact on reducing pressure ulcers, lymphedema, and other issues with the power wheelchair users. Our air chair just came on the market. The first units rolled off in water parks in Texas, and I'm getting emails and links on Facebook of kids for the first time being able to drive through a pool of water, or spraying each other with hoses, fighting on two pirate ships at Morgan's Inspiration Island. So it's kind of hard. To me, the most gratifying thing is not the technologies we develop, but the impact they've had on people's lives. Mm-hmm. And to me, the most fun thing is when I see those. Two things, actually. One of them is when people tell me about how wonderful this or that is without knowing that I'm one of the inventors or Hurl is one of the inventors. And, you know, you meet them in an airport or something like that or at a hotel and they say, oh, hey, man, you use the surge hand rims too. I love those. Those things are really cool. You can't believe how they've changed my life. I don't have shoulder pain anymore. How about you? Does it help you too?
And do you tell them eventually?
Eventually, yeah. You let them talk for a while and say, oh, thank you. I usually say, thanks for contributing to my retirement. And they're like, what do you mean? I say, I'm one of the inventors. I get a little bit of royalties off of that. It came out of Hurl. And then they're like, well, who are you? I said, I'm Rory Cooper. Oh, you're Dr. Cooper. I read about you on the web. So that's kind of fun. Or just now on social media, right? Where you go, when you can read somebody on somebody's website, oh, this changed my child's life, or this is, this is awesome. That's really what it's about, right? Making a positive difference in people's lives.
You and your lab are at the forefront of wheelchair technology, I would say. What does the future of the wheelchair look like?
Robotics. It's going to get, they're going to, we're going to, if you look at self-driving cars, that's kind of looks, I think, the future of wheelchairs to some extent. Mm. Giving more people more autonomy. It's sort of the self-driving car, and then on the other side, better human-machine interfaces. Mm-hmm. So if you look about it, we've always been about that, about sort of advanced technology and human-machine interfaces. Even with manual chairs, it was the physical interface. We still do some of that with power chairs. And on power sources, I think, is the other one. You can see cars moving from internal combustion gasoline engines, and you saw natural gas and propane, and then electric vehicles, like hybrid vehicles. Now fuel cells are starting to come in. The new chair, the air-powered, right, is moving away from standard lead-acid batteries. Early on, when we work with Yamaha, we work on nickel-cadmium batteries and the nickel-metal hydride batteries. With the iBot, we did nickel-cadmium, nickel-metal hydride, then lithium-ion, lithium polymer. So we've kind of been pushing those for quite some time, but there's still a lot more to be done in alternative power sources as well. And then the service delivery model. So we've got people like Brad DiCiano and Mike Boninger and my wife Rosie Cooper, Mark Schmaler, that are working on how do you better get research into practice? Mm-hmm. How do you make that happen faster? How do we so we speed up the adoption rate? And we've got people like John Perlman who are trying to bring these advances both in service delivery and in technology to low-income countries. So it's not just the people in the United States, Europe, and mm-hmm. some parts of Asia, specifically Japan, Korea, that benefit to that. This information and technology gets disseminated worldwide. So the impact is now we're not local; our impact's global,
right.
And our technologies we work on in wheelchairs and robotics and cognitive aids and actually telerehabilitation in order to improve service delivery.
So for you, what does the future of Hurl look like? What's next?
Like I said, with the technology areas, more diversity. We've always, I think, been on the forefront of including people with disabilities and women in Hurl, and I want to grow that. I'd like to make that actually be a model for others as well. So, like John has been doing to disseminate across the world the technologies and the service delivery. And now Mark Schmaler and Rosie and Brad have disseminated our technologies and across the United States. I think we need to get, we can influence STEM education and get greater opportunities for people with disabilities, including our veterans with disabilities. We've, you know, grown more into the veterans space and like veterans education, mm-hmm. veterans transition assistance, because of the for veterans with disabilities, because of the opportunities in STEM. I think that's something we'll continue to grow in HURL. I'd like to see HURL, like I said earlier, you know, find a naming opportunity and so that we have some long-term stability. And also, I think we want to continue to improve our technology transfer. We're generating more patents now. We're working more closely with the technology transfer in the VA, the Innovation Center in the VA, and the Innovation Institute of the University, to train innovators so they could go out and start new businesses, because there's, I think, a lot of opportunity there, and to accelerate the pace of research and development into both clinical practice and into products that get in people's hands. So, you know, I invented the smart wheel in 1986. It actually didn't come to market till 2002.
Wow.
That's, if you look in the air chair, we started 3 years ago, even just investigating the motors and the feasibility, mm-hmm. and it's on the market now. We didn't even start making the first power chair prototype. We had a scooter prototype. We started making a power chair prototype. Designing the power chair prototype in June of 2016. It was on the market by June of 2017. Not that we could do that with everything. You need kind of a balance of things that take longer term and things that shorter term. But if it can be done shorter term, I'd like to have the resources to do that. The other thing is there's still a tremendous... Technology has tremendous potential, and there's tremendous need for people with disabilities to benefit from that technology.
Mm-hmm. And I know you work a lot with the veteran community, obviously. Can mm-hmm. you talk about that, those interactions, and also what groups specifically that you're working with?
Paralyzed Veterans of America has been a supporter forever, mm-hmm. but we have great relationships with many of the veteran service organizations, Disabled American Veterans, Disabled Veterans National Foundation, the Wounded Warrior Project, American Legion, VFW, they all support what we're doing, either through dissemination of information, some cases financially, some participating in our research, generating research ideas. We're also changing our research to be more consumer-driven, the ideas coming from the consumer, so we're doing a big voice of the consumer, voice of the provider study. We've always kind of done that in a less formal way because of our clinic at the Center for Assistive Technology and our relationships with these organizations, but now trying to formalize that data gathering, which is more feasible now with the social media mechanisms for gathering opinions and perspectives and needs. And then locally, we're very engaged with Mission Continues and Team Red, White, and Blue, and the Veterans Leadership Program, and Steel City Veterans. So that helps. We're engaged with the VA itself, Office of Research and Development, the Technology Transfer, Innovation, mm-hmm. The clinical side too. With the DOD, we partnered with the Center for Rehabilitation Science Research at the Uniformed Services University, the EACE, which is the Extremity and Amputation Center of Excellence, which is a joint VA-DOD center out of San Antonio. We've partnered with Walter Reed's Military Advanced Training Center, or MATSE, and also the center, the NICA, the National Intrepid Center of Excellence, and the Wounded Warrior Regiment from the Marine Corps and the Army Warrior Transition Command. Hmm. So we plan to continue to do those and support things like the Veterans Wheelchair Games and the Warrior Games. And the other thing that's, I think, the future for us is building our international collaboration. So we work a little bit with the University of Alberta in Edmonton and Martin Ferguson Pell and his group. And we've had a long relationship with Lee Kirby up in Dalhousie University and Urs Schneider at Stuttgart and the Fraunhofer Institute and Jongbae Kim at Yonsei University and Hisashi Onabe at Nagano University. So to continue and build on those collaborations and others, so we can, we know what's going on globally and get things out globally faster and also pick up on global advances and increase our subject pool too.
Hurl has long been a magnet for students with disabilities, for people training, and you work with undergrads as well graduate students. Was that a natural progression, or was that one of your goals when you started?
That was one of my goals. I wanted a lab where one you could do soup to nuts, where you could come up with an idea, develop it, create it, test it. And then try it in the clinic and then disseminate it broadly and all the way from small-scale focus groups to multi-site clinical trials. But the other part is create an inclusive workplace. You know, it's kind of the back to the disability advocacy days of, you know, sort of nothing about us without us. There was no way that we were going to create HURL without having it, having people with disabilities have a substantial role in HURL. At all levels.
Any questions?
So I wanted to ask about what it was like leaving California behind and moving to Pittsburgh. I know when you had a job offer at one point in Illinois, your wife said, I'm not shoveling snow anywhere outside of Germany. So how did that transition go?
Well, the early transition was not easy. We arrived to 27 inches of snow in Pittsburgh and were snowed in for a few days. And fortunately, we have some great neighbors that helped us out. And my wife still doesn't have to shovel snow. We've had friends and neighbors be able to help us with that over the years. But, I had to leave. She had to leave her family in Germany. We had to leave I left my family in California. That was difficult. The four seasons were a bit difficult. On the other hand, the veterans community and the disability community have been very welcoming of both of us. And we're now deeply rooted in the Pittsburgh community and have some wonderful relationships. I'll tell you the other part that is a challenge then and actually exists to be a challenge is California is much more progressive on inclusiveness about people with disabilities and just people in a more inclusive culture. Pittsburgh's a friendly Midwestern city, or at least perceives itself to be a Midwestern city. I realize from Philadelphia it's considered a primitive backwater. The culture's changing, and I think bringing companies like Google and as the University of Pittsburgh grows and Carnegie Mellon's very diverse, that the culture will change. The culture has been changing for the positive to be more inclusive, at all levels. But it's still different.
In terms of both the city and the university, how was that in terms of accessibility and sort of how has that changed over time?
Well, Pittsburgh is geographically challenged for accessibility, right? So it's an older city and there's lots of hills, and so that makes it difficult. And, you know, you can put curb cuts in, but if it's on a really steep hill, that's still not much of help. So, you know, that's... But the city at least is taking that seriously and doing assessment for sidewalks and working on public transportation. Employment is kind of the big barrier. There's physical barriers to employment, and there's the biggest barrier actually to employment for people with disabilities, and from my perspective, is the social barrier, getting people to understand, to welcome people with disabilities in the workplace, and to be understanding of their needs, going beyond accommodation and the legal aspects. I see Chancellor Gallagher starting to make those changes at the University of Pittsburgh, but I think that for a long time, it was more a legal obligation rather than a moral imperative.
Mm-hmm. When you first came here, you said you were sort of in a bathroom and a locker room. Did you have colleagues that you were, were you part of a community at the university when you got here? Or were you sort of on your own?
I had Mike Boninger, and then Rick Robertson came out for a while from California, and then he went back and started his own business. I felt like in some ways I had to build my own community. There were very few faculty with disabilities on campus. There were not really many people working in this, and I was a bit isolated from my colleagues in the department. They were originally they were in Forbes Tower on campus, and then they moved out to U Park, which is the university's Pittsburgh's Applied Research Center, about 10 miles from here. That was challenging. That made it particularly hard when you think about, we left our family, we didn't have that support, and then we had the work. I was isolated. I will say that the people in the VA were wonderful, and we built a community around the VA, and they always have been very, very supportive of what I do.
How was it finding accessible housing in Pittsburgh?
Almost impossible. We live about 18 miles outside the city in a beautiful ranch house. We had to do a lot of modifications to make it accessible, and now it's fully accessible. That was a bit of a challenge too, because you had to find contractors and things like that. We had to stay in a hotel for a while our house was made accessible. So that's accessible, affordable housing, not only for low-income people with disabilities, but moderate, all income levels in Pittsburgh is a challenge, and modest income people too. That's something the area still needs to work on. The university also just needs to work on providing more housing for students with disabilities, especially like graduate students and postdocs, so they could come here and have a place to live until they find a place, especially since there is such a shortage of accessible housing.
The university.
And when I first came here, I was almost impossible to find a dentist, for example, right?
What is the challenge with finding?
They just weren't accessible. They were upstairs, or the dental exam rooms were too small to get a wheelchair in, or they had a dental chair that you couldn't transfer into, all of those. I mean, actually, even a lot of the doctor's clinics, fortunately, I'm eligible for the VA, and the VA has sort of national standards, but outside the VA, in the private sector hospitals, and even UPMC at the time, it really wasn't until the late 1990s, or really it was in the early 2000s that UPMC started looking at how do you become more accessible. And there's still, as an employee, there's a lot of the businesses, including the University of Pittsburgh, where they can make improvements in accommodations.
Mm-hmm. Are the buses in Pittsburgh accessible?
The buses are pretty good. And the kneeling buses have been a huge breakthrough for accessibility. The problem is that there's still not as much, ideally every bus would be fully accessible, and every driver would be trained. And accommodating. So physically we're getting better there. That's still another thing. And it's about attitudes, right? It takes a little longer for a person in a power chair to get on the bus, and the bus driver feels anxious, the other passengers, and you have to get to the point where people just accept that that's the way it is, right? And we should just relax a little bit. The extra 30 seconds isn't going to kill anybody.
Yeah. I think that's it.
Do you have anything you want to add that we didn't cover that you would like to
talk about? Well, I think that we should talk about, since Pittsburgh, we have all the self-driving cars and stuff here. And I think that has a lot of potential for people with disabilities and older adults, but it also has a lot of potential, if we're not careful, to leave them behind. And we had that problem with the smartphones when they first came out. I mean, they're wonderful, like people with who are deaf can text, and you know, that's texting is even probably more ubiquitous than calling on the phone, and so that was a tremendous breakthrough. But then, you know, everybody got rid of keyboards and wanted touch screens, and they made this device that everybody was using largely inaccessible to people who are visually impaired. Now, voice navigation has got to the point where it's pretty good and it's been more welcoming, but you got to be careful that these technologies, as they are developed, are also inclusive. I think self-driving cars have a tremendous potential if you can't drive at all, and you can have a self-driving car, but you got to be able to find the car. The car's got to find you. You got to be able to get in it. You got to get your stuff in it. You got to be able to get out of it. I think that's, you know, those sort of, which we have to be aware of as well.
Any other questions? Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you. Mm-hmm.